I'm supposed to get this thing started, but there's a hell of a conversation going on up here, and I don't want you to pay any attention to it. Good morning. I'm Sidney Harmon, and it's my pleasure to introduce the morning. I do so by reminding you of a quite impressive comment made some decades ago about the wonderful poet Robert Frost, who said that the human mind is an astonishing instrument. It turns on automatically when we get out of bed in the morning, and it does not turn off until we get to the office. Robert Frost never met either of these two guys. Theirs hasn't turned off since the day of their birth. Those of you who were here a year ago heard Karl Rove in what I recall as an absolutely stunning presentation, weaving all through material of great consequence, but weaving through it with wit, with knowledge, and with remarkable tolerance for those among us who didn't agree with him for a damn minute. The guy is indisputably one of the brilliant minds and great charmers of the earth. So be careful with him this morning. He will undoubtedly seduce you as he has time and again seduced me. A few weeks ago, at a book party at Carl's home for Walter's absolutely magnificent new treatise on Einstein, we were chatting, and this guy charmed me by telling me that Walter had suggested that I had something to do with the origin of the book. Reminded me that Walter had come to my office some years ago, destitute, penniless, desperate for employment. And as he waited for me, I kept him waiting a few hours, of course, he saw hanging on the wall a precious gift to me by my precious Janie, a letter by Albert Einstein to a student who had written complaining of the dismal treatment he saw Einstein receiving from the journalists of the day. And Einstein's reply translates essentially into this: "Be of good spirit, my boy. Dogs have been baying at the moon for eons. The moon is still there." I suggested to Karl Rove that he ought to pay attention to that. And yes, it was pandering of a sort, but it's inescapable in the presence of really one of the significant and dominant intellects of our day. He and our resident polymath, Walter Isaacson, are about to engage in a conversation, and I'm going to get the hell out of the way.
Thank you, Sidney. Thank you very much. And I think that's the point of the Ideas Festival. We're having, like, instead of a poetry slam, it's a charm slam, where you get Bill Clinton and Karl Rove to see who can charm the people on the other side most easily.
Clinton. So, Clinton.
Yeah, I'm betting on Clinton. My money's on Clinton. He was pretty good.
Yeah.
But I do thank you for coming. I know it's a long trip, and I know you're not exactly coming into the heart of the base or whatever here in Aspen. And it's very kind of you to come.
So yesterday I'm driving in, and I come over Fremont Pass and over Independence Pass, and on the way I stop for a cup of coffee in Twin Lakes. And I walk in at the Nordic Inn. I'm Nordic. I'm a Norwegian. So anything that says Scandinavian, the Nordic peoples, we stick together. So I go in and try and get a cup of decaf, and the owner comes out and he says, "You won't remember me. My name is Charles Grady." He said, "I was the last Democrat state representative from East Dallas before you all ran us out."
Glad he came to Pritkin County.
And we had a kind conversation about mutual friends, most of whom were defeated Democratic politicians in Texas. So I said, while he's having somebody rustle up some decaf, I said, can I use the facility? So he said, yeah, right around there. So I go use the facility. So I'm coming back. There's a guy at the front desk there, and Grady's telling me, he says, you won't believe who's here. He said, Karl Rove is here. And the guy says, I'd like to hit that son of a bitch. And Grady says, he's right behind you. I knew I was getting close to Aspen. So I get checked in last night, and I'm still in Washington time, so we got dinner at the Malik's, and it's going to be a little while, so I go down to the front desk to see if they've got a snack bar, you know, someplace you can get a candy bar or something, and of course they don't. They got the $9 little thing with the very cute thing there at the bar, but I don't know what it was, but it was only about this size, one chip, one thing, I don't know. So I'm walking out, and there's a guy in the Land Rover, the very expensive Land Rover. And he's got the car full of people, takes one look at me, scowl on his face, and says, go home. So as he was driving off, I yelled at him, I am. I was born in Denver, and the first place I ever lived is about 20 miles away from here, it's no longer here. It's Kokomo, Colorado. It's south of the Climax Mine, north of the Climax Mine. It's now about 200 feet under the surface of the tailings pond. I wanted to run after the guy and say, when the hell did you come to Aspen? I was here in 1951. Yeah. Who's go home yourself. Go back to whatever wealthy enclave on the far eastern coast of the United States or the far western coast where you fly from on your jet. Unfortunately, I didn't figure that all out until afterwards. So, I mean, I'm here. Don't be so mean to me.
Yeah, well, you saved it for us. In fact, your dad was a geologist here, right? I mean, you grew up in this area. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your connection there, your father.
Yeah. My dad was a hard rock geologist, Colorado School of Mines, and started off working uranium projects for the U.S. Geological Survey when he was in school on the Western Slope out here in Frutira and Grand Junction and down in the San Juans. And then when I was growing up, we lived here until I was 10, about 9 and a half or 10, and then moved to another. We lived in Kokomo, Golden, and Arvada, and then we moved to the great metropolitan area of Sparks, Nevada. But he was a hard rock geologist and spent a lot of his time here.
Well, let's leap right in. You were talking to Colin Powell. You heard what he said here. Next year, are we going to be withdrawing troops from Iraq and redefining that mission?
My sense is, yes, we will be redefining the mission, because the goal of the surge was to get us to a place where we could redefine the mission, to take it to something close to what Baker Hamilton says, which is, our goal is to be in a place where the United States' principal role is to help protect the territorial integrity of Iraq, to hunt down al-Qaeda and jihadist elements, to assist and train the Iraqi army, and to provide force protection to our assets there. And the object is, how do you get there? And we were getting there in 05 and 06 until the Samarra bombing, which set off a wave of sectarian violence that plunged Baghdad into disarray and made it impossible for the government to take steps towards reconciliation and even to control its own territory. So the surge is an effort to get to a place. The goal is not an infinite number of American troops there for an infinite number of years. The goal is to get the country stabilized in a place where we can begin bringing U.S. combat troops home and reconfiguring to a different mission.
So even if they don't have a good political stability under a Maliki government, it's about time to say, let's focus on the Baker Hamilton mission, which would mean perhaps, what, one-third of the troops?
Well, look, first of all, Baker Hamilton, read the report carefully. Page 72, for example, says, we could support a surge of troops if it was necessary and thought by the commanders on the ground to be prudent to stabilize Baghdad, because the Baker Hamilton Commission recognized that you cannot have the kind of stability we want in Iraq if the capital city, that's one quarter of the population, is unstable. And the purpose of the surge was to do two things. One is to take Anbar, which 6 months ago people were declaring was lost, and to make it not lost, and to stabilize Baghdad so that the government had the space with which, in which it could take steps for political reconciliation. And, you know, look, the troops have now been there for 3 weeks. All of them have been there for 3 weeks. The major operations have been underway for 2 weeks. We've got a lot of time yet to go before we know what is going to happen. Petraeus says September is the point at which he thinks he'll have the first inkling of what the long-term ramifications are. But we already know a couple of things. We know, first of all, that the level of violence against our troops and the level of IEDs, big IEDs, going off against the civilians is up. We know that sectarian deaths are down. Whether those are long-term trends or what the reaction is going to be in August or September or October, we have yet to see, but we're starting to see some things. And Anbar is probably where we've seen the most remarkable turnaround. Who would have thought 6 months ago that Anbar, which was considered to be lost, we now see the vast majority of the Sunni tribes joining with the central government in Baghdad in an effort called the Awakening, in which the Sunni tribes are staffing up the police and providing personnel for the military, both in Anbar and outside of Anbar, in order to confront the foreign fighters in their midst.
You know, I was reading Secretary Bob Gates and then President Bush's July 4th speech, both of which seem to be pretty clear that we're now thinking, what is the post-surge strategy? What was the president, what was his main message on July 4th? Because it got many different reporting styles.
Yeah, well, look, he's been saying this thing about our goal is not to have troops there indefinitely in the combat mission that they're in today, but to get to a point where our mission, our footprint is smaller, and our mission has been redefined. He's been saying that for months. But the July 4th attempt was to say, on a day where not too many other players are out there, at a Air National Guard base in West Virginia, to say, in essence, that. And instead, they picked up on the paragraph that said there'll be a lot more sacrifice called for in the months ahead as we confront.
But the main point is that we actually will be drawing troops down by next year, probably.
Aspirationally, our goal is to put it in a different place. I'm not going to say when the date is that American troop levels begin to go down. But the goal is to do exactly that, to put ourselves in a place where the U.S. combat footprint is smaller. I mean, the idea is the surge doesn't last indefinitely. The object of the surge is to clear and allow the Iraqis the time to get everything in there to properly hold and to do enough damage to the infrastructure of the enemy that it is hard for the enemy to come back. And,
who's the enemy specifically? Well, Al-Qaeda, assuming
you got, you got, you got, you got essentially three. You got Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is, our intelligence is that 80 to 90% of the bombs going off are AQI. So the object is to get after them in order to deal with that. Then there are Sunni insurgencies that are at war with the government. And the object is to take on those. Now, some of those groups that had problems with the government, like the 1920 Brigade, have now said, okay, there's now a political space that we can now operate in, so we will now turn on those that are not willing to play inside that political space. And the third, frankly, are just criminal elements. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of some of what we see over there is just, you know, okay, there's a middle-class Iraqi, let's go grab him and hold him for ransom. Or there is a enterprise underway, let's go steal it.
You know, we have a fourth problem, which is all the wacky Shia militia who are extremist Shia.
Well, I'd put them in that third group because, I mean, you know, from the beginning, one of the interesting things is this began with Maliki coming to the president and Amman Jordan saying, I need help in order to take on the Shia militia and the foreign fighters, the Shia militia, because the absence of what he calls a one-gun policy. There ought to be one centralized security force in the country, not competing armies of private militias. This is making it difficult for us to establish control, create political reconciliation, and take on foreign fighters, whose object is the end of the regime.
If you were Maliki's campaign manager, maybe you should be, because he's having some problems. Are we sure he can get his act together?
Well, look, first of all, let's be clear about this. How long has this guy been in power? One year and less than 2 months.
Y'all had invaded Iraq by then. No, not quite. No, I mean, it's a while.
Well, but he's been in, he's in a country that does not know democracy and has no democratic tradition.
So you're saying, yes, you have faith in Malik.
Yeah, you've got to. Otherwise, what your option is to say we should either just walk away and let whatever happen, or we ought to do what was done during the Vietnam War when, you know, the U.S. government in the mid-60s expressed dissatisfaction with the leadership in Vietnam and unilaterally made the decision of replacing an elected government. And I'm not certain we necessarily want to go down that path again.
Mm-hmm. Immigration, you ended last year with a great peroration, I think it was, the need for an immigration reform, comprehensive, and why that it's at the soul of what this country's about. What happened?
Politics got in the way. It's even more important that we do this. And we better, as a country, face up to the problem that we have. And look, I understand the strong emotions about this. I understand that a lot of people wake up and say, I'm worried about America not being America. I understand people who say, I don't like people who came here illegally, and why should they get something? And I know people saying, we should not repeat the mistakes in 1986 when we passed a immigration reform law that basically said, if you came here and you're illegal and you want to be a citizen, raise your right hand. Now, what happened between last year and this is that McCain-Kennedy got defeated. And then some of the opponents of McCain-Kennedy took a sober look after the election and said, is this a problem that we need to confront? And if so, what is it that we most care about in this battle? And some of those opponents came forward. In fact, so ironically enough, you know, Congress is a formal institution, but a lot of this happens informally. Part of this sort of sounding each other out back and forth took place during a hunting trip in which two of the opponents of it said, We were opposed to McCain-Kennedy because we're worried about the future flow. How do you remove the magnet, the attraction for future flow of illegal immigrants? You can't remove it entirely by having a temporary worker program. You can only remove the magnet by making it impossible for somebody who's illegal to get hired. So we're willing to engage in discussions about a grand compromise in which we get border security, temporary worker, resolving the status of the 12 million, or 8 million, whatever number it is, and as long as a component of that is employee verification in a way that makes it likely that we will not have this repeated again 10 years from now. And thus began all the discussions about that ended up in the grand bargain, in which, you know, for months, Secretary Chertoff and Secretary Guterres met quietly with a wide variety of people on the Hill, Democrats and Republicans, to basically serve as honest brokers, provide facts, encourage the conversation, and we came together with this piece of legislation. They did, and we backed them in doing so. And frankly, you could take any single element of this thing and be unhappy about it. But taken all together as a package, it put America in a very positive new direction on immigration. First of all, it locked into place the things that we're doing on border security, which I want to come back to in a minute. Secondly, it created a temporary worker program where willing workers could be matched with willing employers for jobs that Americans are not doing. And believe me, we're getting tougher on the border so that it's getting harder for people to get here. And as a result, we're seeing some impact on our labor market. In the early 90s, as I said last year, you could get yourself a coyote for $100 to $150 bucks to get you across the Texas-Mexico border. Today, it's now $2,500. Last year, it was between a range of about $1,500 and I think $2,200, and it's continued to escalate. October of 06, they count Texas and Oklahoma for ag labor reporting statistics as one market, and they give an annual number, October over October. October of 06 over October of 05, there are 23% fewer farm laborers in Oklahoma and Texas than there were in 05, and wages are 7% higher. Now, I don't think there are one quarter fewer farm workers because we're growing one quarter fewer cows and crops. It's getting that much harder to get across the border. So, willing worker, match with a willing employer in a temporary worker program. Employer verification, which was one of the elements that allowed us to bring people across from no to yes. And what employer verification said was, look, we've got a lot of very good corporate citizens in America trying to do the right thing. But it is impossible for us to do this with the system that we now have in place. A woman came to me with a landscaping company and said, I hire 12 or 13 people a year. Don't count on me to be an expert in document fraud. And we saw a clear example of this in the Swift meatpacking plant case, One of the things that we've done as an administration is we've said we're going to have a policy of deliberately going after people who knowingly hire illegal aliens. Now, SWIFT did not knowingly hire illegal aliens, but we stumbled onto the back end of a process that was involved in providing fraudulent documents to people to go get a job with SWIFT. Now, SWIFT was a good corporate citizen. They had an HR department that asked the right questions. They had lawyers advising them, so they went up right to the line. They did everything they possibly could to advertise widely for workers as broadly as possible and give training programs and so forth so that there was no excuse for if somebody wanted a job that paid 16, 18, 20 bucks an hour in little towns across America where they had plants, they had a chance to apply. And yet when we went in and went through five of their plants, between a quarter and 40% of their workers were illegal. And they were able to get jobs because they showed up with driver's licenses, birth certificates, and other documents, which to the eye of a very highly trained human resources department look like legitimate documents. So the employee verification part of this was really, really important. And then finally, the issue of resolving the situation of the 12 million. We didn't repeat the mistake of 86 where it said, you know, raise your hand, you're now a citizen of the Estados Unidos. We said, if you want to become a U.S. citizen, you got to surface. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take your 10 fingerprints, and while you're sitting there, we're going to check those 10 fingerprints. This may surprise you. You know how many fingerprint checks are done every day in America? On average, 3.2 million. So doing a couple hundred thousand more fingerprint checks, because it's all electronic, just put it on the pad, takes a picture, runs it against the database. So we can find out, did you do something bad while you've been here? We're going to give you a card, and over the next 2 months, we're going to then go do more background checks on you. And if you then want to stay in the United States as a temporary worker, you pay a fine and a processing fee. And you pay an impact fee, to help relieve some of the local governments of the cost of health and education. You get to stay for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if you want to stay another 4 years, you have to pay another fine and fee. You stay four more years, and then if you want to adjust your status and get in the line to get a green card, you have to go to a U.S. consulate outside the United States, pay another processing fee to pay the cost of the whole project, and then wait up to 5 years to get your green card in order to then become a citizen. During this whole process, at the beginning, you have to demonstrate that you either have English proficiency or you're enrolled in a class to help you learn to read, write, and speak English. And at the end of the process, before you can become a United States citizen, you have to show that you can read, write, and speak English and take a civics test that is more than where is the capital of the United States, A, Washington, B, Buffalo, C, Aspen. Now, this was a good bill. It had flaws, and I could point to, you know, there are things that we didn't like, there are things that everybody didn't like. But it put us on a rational course. It also did a couple other things that were really important to the future of the country. We have an immigration system today that says there is a priority for you coming into the country based on whether you are related to somebody already here. If you are an uncle or an aunt or a mom or a dad or a brother or sister, niece or nephew, you get more points and get a higher priority. This dialed the system away from that to say that the priority is now on the three E's. Do you have education, employment history, or English skills that would tend to indicate that you'd be a positive contribution to society? We still kept family in there, but rather than being dialed dominantly towards family, we moved it so that it was more towards, a majority was now towards the three E's. The other thing we got is a system in which people who want to become a U.S. citizen wait forever to become a U.S. citizen. And as part of the grand bargain, we said that everybody who's standing in line today is going to be processed in the next 8 years. Because some of those people will have to wait 20 and 30 years to come into the United States legally if the system continues as it was. Now, it's a good system, but it is, I readily admit, a contentious and enormously, it's something that's deeply emotional to people. Now, I will also suggest to you that it is based on a lack of information about the thing that scares them the most, and that is what's being done to secure our borders. I've had an unusual experience the last couple of months going around the country doing some mostly Republican Party things to sort of, you know, relieve the sentiment, you know, sort of let them be heard about it. And, of course, they always have the ugly question about immigration. So I want you to participate in a little mental exercise with me. I want you to think about last year, and I want you to get fixed in your mind the number of people that you think we apprehended at the border and returned back outside the United States of America. Now, I suspect you're not the normal audience that I've been talking to recently about this, so you might have a slightly different number, but everybody get fixed on a number. Anybody want to suggest to me what your number is? 10,000? 50,000? 1.3 million. In fact, why don't you go to slide?
Carl has brought some PowerPoints. Look at the screens on each side.
Let's go to slide 12. Last year we had...
Up on the screen, please? No, it's not. Can you put it up on the screens there? All right.
Last year we had 1.3 million that we apprehended and returned across the border. Nearly 1 million of them were Canadians or Mexicans who get apprehended and returned literally either the same day or within 24 hours. We also returned 280,000 people who had to go through some formal removal process. 95,000 of them had committed another crime. We put a special emphasis on seeking out aliens inside the United States who have committed a crime. So we've kicked out 95,000 of them. We've got 81,000 who are OTMs. I love immigration lingo. OTMs are other than Mexicans.
It's up on that screen there, so don't worry about the other screen. I think that's the best we're going to do. Is it? Huh?
I'll draw you a word picture. Don't worry about it. There are
81,000. Cindy donated the visual system as well as the audio system.
There are 81,000 that are OTMs, other than Mexicans. That's actually an official term in government lingo.
Other than Mexicans?
Other than Mexicans.
No.
The reason is because if you are a Canadian or a Mexican, we have the legal authority to basically toss you back across the border. If you are an OTM, we have to have an agreement in place with your home country as to how we will process you out of the country. This is the group that heretofore has been subject to catch and release. If we caught you, we released you, and we gave you a little piece of paper and said, here's your immigration court hearing, please show up. And for the last 30 years, 92% of them have not shown up. And I'm not certain it's in the interest of the United States to retain the other 8%. And then we had 37,000 that had previously had a so-called removal order against them. This may surprise you. Of the people who are here illegally in the United States today, 1/3 of them came here legally. They came here on a visa and overstayed. So this latter category are people who overstayed their visa. We knew when their visa was up. At some point long after their visa was up, we went to court and sanctioned them, so we had a formal removal order waiting for them. Now, I think, you know, when I go out, most of the people who are most concerned about this issue have absolutely no idea, like the fellow here in the front row did, of what the number is. They have no idea. I get 1,000. I was at a group of talk radio guys and had them go through this exercise and then asked them, I said, let's start, who's got, you know, anybody with, you know, 10,000? We got up to half a million, and they started hooting at the guy who said 500,000, and the number's 1.3 million, and these are the guys talking about the issue. So there's a lot of...
That may be a problem in a way. Haven't you stoked up that talk radio divisiveness partisanship, and now it comes back to bite us?
Yeah, that was my plan in 1988. I personally stoked it all up. I've got a vast army of talk radio hosts that I've personally recruited. I've engineered the financing for them. I actually also did that with Al Franken because I thought that was a new, nice counter move to get him out
that
there.
That actually worked very well, didn't
it?
Yeah. Right. But you know my point, that the that somehow we've gotten into a, you said this was a rational
Yeah, I got CNN
approach.
To hire Lou Dobbs. That was my most familiar maneuver on it. I thought that was really
Let's not go there. I kept him from having fun. All right, let's move on to other contentious issues. Valerie,
can I say one other thing? Let's go to the next slide, just for the heck of it.
13, yeah.
This shows that I asked this to be tracked. If you don't measure it, you can't solve it. So we started tracking in 2004 the gap between those that we caught on OTMs and those that we removed. And it was big and pretty consistent. So we tried an experiment in 2005 at DHS called Operation Texas Hold'em. Because Brazilians came across the border primarily in the lower Rio Grande Valley sector of the border, and also to a lesser extent the Laredo. But that's virtually every Brazilian who enters the U.S. illegally comes there. So we said, okay, we're going to take whatever amount of resources are necessary and grab every Brazilian, and we're not going to let a single one of them go. And we're going to do whatever is necessary in the way of extraordinary resources to house them, hold the hearing, and process them out of the country, and see if this doesn't have a result back in Brazil. So the message is, you come up, You get on the plane from Rio, you get yourself to Mexico City, you get on the bus to the border, you hire the coyote, you get across the border, they grab you, and you no longer, you know what they called your immigration hearing notice in Brazil? A permiso, a permission slip. So no longer will you get the permiso, instead you'll get put in a cell, you'll get processed, and put on a plane back to Rio. And we did this, and it cost a lot of money. But what we found is that 6 weeks later, apprehensions of Brazilians coming across the border in Texas had dropped 90%. Now, the reason wasn't that they were getting a lot smarter and getting across. It was that the message got out, we're going to get caught and get returned. So this, we then began, we had been putting resources into it. We've got 40% more beds to hold these people, 7,700 more beds to hold people. Plus, when we came into office, it took 93 days to process them out of the country. It now takes 19. So if you've got 40% more beds and you're processing them through there four times as fast, you're suddenly able to get to this place. You see the gap. The solid line are the apprehensions. The dotted line are the releases. Are the detentions. Top line is the guys we arrested. The dotted line are the ones that we held on to. And as you can see, the week of, ironically enough, July 17th of last year, they crossed. And we literally now, if you are an OTM, you don't get released. You get processed back to the country from which you came. Now, it's costing us a lot of money to do that. It costs us $97 a day for three squares and the cost of supervising you, not the capital cost, but just the cost of clean bed sheets, three squares a day, and whatever resources we have to put, particularly for your family. We've got to make certain your kids are getting some kind of education and attention. We've got to provide some modicum of health care to you. So it's costly, but it is really vital that we do this in order to have people have confidence that we're serious about controlling the border. Because if we don't, if people think that we've got this, and we've had this for 30 years, Republicans and Democrats alike have tolerated this. And it has been corrosive in people's attitudes towards the border. Just is. It's not giving people confidence that their government is on their side when it comes to the border. But this isn't enough to solve the problem. We better work on all the other problems of this, assimilation, resolving the status of the people who are here illegally, worker, employer verification, and temporary worker program, or this is all not going to matter, because they're going to be, you don't have enough resources to control the border if people are desperate to feed themselves and there's a job in the United States of America that allows them to feed their kids. Just aren't.
Last year, when we talked about the Valerie Plame Wilson case, you said, you know, it's still under adjudication, hard to talk about. I think Scott McClellan at one point came out and said you had nothing to do with any of this, but it turns out you did and others did.
Actually, what he said was I didn't have anything to do with revealing her name. Now, look, this is still in a civil case, which is motions are pending on. Yeah. But my contribution to this was to say to a reporter, which is a lesson about talking to reporters, the words, I heard that too.
Yeah. There were a lot of people in the administration putting her name out, it seems, and they were doing it to discredit Joe Wilson. And it seemed like a concerted effort, and nobody came forward and said...
I disagree.
Why didn't you come forward and say, yeah, I said it, and here's why I said it?
I did.
No, I mean publicly before Matt Cooper gets...
Because the FBI said, don't say anything about this.
It seems like a lot of people kept quiet in the administration, having put her name forward, causing a whole rigmarole that probably could have been prevented.
Yeah, I don't agree with you a whole lot. In fact, the record pretty well shows that it is one used her name.
Scooter or Armitage?
Armitage. And Scooter uses it after the story has already been largely picked up and written by Novak.
Why did people put her name out?
But look, here's a guy who goes and says in his article, the Vice President of the United States sent me, Vice President of the United States raised questions, so I was sent, apparently at the insistence of the Vice President, to go check it out, and I came back and reported. I would only recommend you read the July 11th statement by the Director of the CIA, who says he was not sent at the direction of the White House or the Vice President. He was not sent at the direction of the Director of the CIA. He did not come back and give a written report. He came back and gave a verbal report, which was considered to be neither conclusive nor dispositive. In fact, he didn't come back disproving that Iraq had attempted to acquire uranium yellow cake from Niger. He came back with a previously unknown incident where they tried to do exactly that.
Well, why didn't you all just openly say that instead of off-the-record using the name of his wife?
We did. In fact, that's my conversation with Bob Novak is largely about that. And my only contribution is when he says, I've talked to, she is, she had something to do with it, and I said, I've heard that too.
And Matt Cooper, same?
Matt Cooper, I don't remember the conversation with Matt Cooper, but even his own notes of it are, it is an off-the-record conversation on Friday morning when I know that Novak's column has been written and is going to be published, and that the CIA is coming out with a statement that says Joe Wilson was not sent at the direction of the CIA or the CIA director or the vice president, was not dispositive, not conclusive, in fact, added to the case, didn't detract from the case, and was suspect because of the methods that he used to collect the data. And I'm trying to tell Matt Cooper, by his own notes, you ought not to be right. Don't get ahead of yourself on this. Don't be writing about this thing for Time magazine.
Were you involved in the discussions about commuting Libby's prison sentence, and what did you think of it?
No. And look, I think the president's statement I thought was absolutely hit the right tone, which was respectful of the decision that he was guilty of misleading the grand jury, but with a no underlying offense, excessive in its application of the penalty.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about energy this week, both in terms of energy security, like why have we allowed the price of oil to go from $10 a barrel to $70 or $80, and we're sending all that money to Ahmadinejad and the Saudis, and people are going to use it against us, and also about the carbon and what it's doing to our problems with global warming. Is there a sense that you could do something dramatic in this next year to really try to reduce both our dependence on foreign oil more than the 2012, is it planned?
2010.
And reduce the emissions of carbon.
Yeah. Let's take the fuel first. Yes, there is something. And let me see here. Which one should I send you to? Why don't you go to...
Can we get it back on there? Yeah.
Let's go to slide 5. 20 and 10 is the proposal the president laid out in the State of the Union address, which a Supreme Court decision then said we had authority under... existing authority, which we didn't think we had, but they said we do have, to in essence put the 20 and 10 plan largely in place by regulatory structures. 20 and 10 basically aims to reduce our petroleum use by 20% in the next 10 years. And the object is that 20% represents about the percentage of our oil supply that we get from the Persian Gulf. Now, the reason that oil prices are high is that world demand is high, particularly because of the escalation of demand in China and India. World production relatively flat, and if demand is rising, then you're going to get an increase in price. 20 and 10 is, there are four lines over there. The yellow line at the very bottom represents what the current CAFE standards mandated under law would lead to. Now, there's an odd thing in CAFE standards. Under the law, the Department of Transportation is allowed to regulate CAFE standards for light trucks. And we do. We have a very aggressive reform of light trucks, which I think has now been in place for 2.5 years, which is having a significant impact on improving CAFE among light trucks. CAFE for passenger cars is figured in a different way and is set by Congress. Congress literally plucks a number out of there and puts it in, and it's a fleet-wide number. And as a result, has a bunch of weird perversions in it that work to the disadvantage of U.S. companies and to the advantage of foreign companies and drive fleets towards the production of smaller vehicles to offset their big vehicles, and it has all kinds of distortions. What we'd like to do is take and apply to passenger cars what we do with light trucks, which is our reform was to say, we're not going to allow you to have a fleet-wide number. What we're going to say is that there are going to be bins based on weight. So that if you've got a light truck that's a small light truck, you're going to have to be forced to make fuel savings compared to all other small light trucks. And if you've got a big honker, you've got to have fuel efficiency improvements versus all other big honkers. So we look at the fuel efficiency standard of vehicles in a like weight class and say you've got to have constant improvement in each one of these bins towards an annual target of, in this instance, nearly 4%. We want to do that for other vehicles as well, for passenger vehicles, so that if you've got a small car or a mid-range car or a luxury car, you don't get evaluated on the basis of the entire fleet mix. So if you're able to sell a bunch of small cars, it allows you to have no improvement in the big car. Or if you've got no big cars, it allows you to have a smaller improvement in your little car. Instead, we're going to say we're going to compare all of these weights of passenger cars to each other and require there to be 4% improvement per year. Now, that's a long way of saying we want to get something we haven't yet gotten. If we leave things the way they are, the fuel standards are going to improve along that yellow line. If the fuel standards go up as are now currently written under the House bill, they will be the line on the extreme right. That is to say, you can see that it takes a lot longer to get the red line. As you can see, it takes a lot longer to get from where we are to where they want to be, which is 35 miles per gallon. You get there about 2025. Under the Senate bill, which is biofuels only, you get from where we are today to 36 by 2022. If you take the president's proposal of 20 and 10 and do the reform that requires improvement in all weight classes for all classes of vehicles, you get to 35 in 2015. Now, that may shock some of you who think that the president should be arguing for lower standards taking longer, but we think technologically this is possible and doable, but only if we change the way by which we monitor and measure the standard. And instead of saying Toyota gets to compete with a fleet definition that is much narrower than GM, and GM has to find a way to make lots of cheap small cars and give them away in order to hit the fleet-wide number, instead everybody's got to improve in every class, you actually get there faster by doing that. Now, we don't have the authority to do the CAFE standards in 20 and 10, but we do have the ability to do all the stuff that we want to do with setting standards for renewable and alternative fuels, which will allow us, which is going to be a principal driver in allowing us to get to 20% reduction of where we would otherwise be in 10 years.
I understood the general theory of relativity. I'm having trouble with this, which is, why not?
Green is Bush. I'll make it simple, Walter. Green is Bush and is better. Orange is Senate and not as good. And red is the House and not good at all. Not
That's
acceptable.
Why I couldn't understand it. Why not something simpler, just saying, let's have higher tariffs on foreign oil that are coming either from, you know, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Iran. Why not have carbon taxes, and why not take that money and plow it back to the people, whether it's a Montana ranch or whatever gets hard? Yeah. Let the market take care of this charge people
for polluting. The market is taking care of a lot of this by having sustained higher energy prices.
Well, that's just sending the money to Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, well, frankly, tell me how we're not going to be sending money to Ahmadinejad if we, well, first of all, we don't buy from Iran, incidentally.
Well, it's on the world market.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, there we go. I wanted you to make that admission so I can use it against you later on.
Thank you.
There's no way, if you're going to say we're going to have higher energy prices brought about by a carbon tax or by a tariff, and then we're going to try and sort it out so that the fact that it applies less to somebody who lives in a highly congested metropolitan area with relatively well-developed metropolitan transit authorities is going to have a less of an impact than somebody who lives in a more rural part of the country, and we're going to somehow try and figure out how we can ameliorate all that. It is not easy to do.
I was with you last night, so I have on absolute authority that you were not in Pepke Park singing along with the Al Gore climate change concert.
We are the world.
How much do you worry? How much do you worry about climate change? Is it overblown? Is it a real worry?
Yeah, it's a real worry. The question is, it's you got to buy an insurance policy. We don't know. I've labored through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, not just the very short introduction, but the all god dang 800 pages of the thing or whatever it was.
777.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know. We're putting a lot of money into climate science. We put $37 billion into climate research since we came into office. The United States puts more into climate research than the rest of the world combined. And there's a lot that we don't know. But we've got to do, our view is what we ought to do, it's prudent to begin to reduce the growth rate to stabilize and eventually aim by the middle of the century to be in a position where we can begin to reduce. And we need to do this in a way in which all the players are at the table. One of the problems with Kyoto was all the players were not at the table. And we've got to do it in a way that we don't impede economic growth, because economic growth is the way that we're going to be able to put in place the technologies necessary to deal with greenhouse gas emissions.
And you don't think green technology will promote economic growth in this country compared to other countries?
Look,
that's a Tom Friedman argument.
I think it may. I'm going to point to Greenspan, who I think depicts this as an accounting question. But look, I'm not going to. Nobody suggests. Look, if it was economically advantageous for everybody to adopt these technologies today, they'd be adopting them, because in essence, efficiency means that you're using what you got, the energy source, a heck of a lot more efficiently. Means you're using more of it, using less of it to get more out of it.
If you're actually paying for all the costs, though, of emitting CO2,
what is the cost?
The cost is the future generation.
Well, we don't know what the future cost is. So the question is, do we say, okay, we got to put the brakes on economic growth, we got to put the brakes on bringing people up out of poverty in the developing world, we got to change dramatically the way that we do things here in America and impose it upon people because we're fearful of what might be 50 or 100 years out, or do we begin to take prudent steps now? We're in the prudent steps camp. For example, look, one of the big worries we've got is China. The economy is 1/5 as large as the United States. And this year will pass us in order to be the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Think about that. 1/5 our size, and they're putting out more greenhouse gases than we are.
Are we leveling off on greenhouse
gases? Yeah, in fact, thank you for asking that question. First,
I owed it to you after the Valley Plain discussion.
Let's start first with... I think Greg Easterbrook, if you haven't read some of his stuff, I highly recommend it to you. It is really important to get the right frame for thinking about environment in the America. So I've stolen a Greg Easterbrook chart that was bastardized by the EPA. Chart one. Now, this is sort of a complicated chart. It has as its starting period 1970. And the object here is to check the relative change in certain things to each other. The top line there is the gray line at the very top is the change in the gross domestic product, which over these since 1970 has risen 185% in real terms in the United States. The second line is vehicle miles traveled. Y'all are driving far too much. 167% improvement. I can say this as somebody who has a car. I bought a brand new car March 2001. I've driven 30,889 miles on it, so I'm driving less than you. And that makes me better and morally superior because I'm greater than you. The red line is energy consumption. We've increased our energy consumption by 47.5%. We've increased our population by 45%. So our population and energy consumption have gone up roughly together. Our CO2 emissions have gone up 41.5%. Our what's called criteria air pollutant emissions, think of it as pollution, has gone down 52%. So we have shown over this period of time, despite the fact that the economy has grown pretty dramatically, the population has grown pretty well, we're driving a heck of a lot more. At least when it comes to pollution, we've done a much better job of reducing the bad stuff that's coming into our air. Now, what about CO2? Well, first, let's take a look at the decade of the 90s, because in the decade of the 90s, when the world starts to begin to get serious about measuring this, number two. Now, this is a change in CO2 emissions from 1990 to 2000. Now, Russia is the only country in the world that has significant reductions. And that's because the economy goes to hell in a handbasket. Now, the EU27, the broader definition of the EU, which includes most of the former Soviet bloc, also has a decline. But again, driven by the same thing, that a lot of particularly gooky, heavy industrial plants used to sustain the Soviet regime now go away. But as you can see, between 1990 and 2000, the United States is down there with a 17.7% increase in emissions while our economy has grown 38%. Europe has a 25% increase in its economy and a 1% increase. Now, that's the decade of the 90s. But we begin to set in place, starting with the 1990 Clean Air Act and other things that begin to have an impact, and we also have investments in technology that begin to have an impact. Let's go to number three. This is the trend in CO2 emissions from 2000 to 2004. Russia grows its economy by 26% and gets a 1% increase in CO2. Our economy grows 9.6% and has a 1.7%. As you can see, the rest of the world ain't doing as good as the U.S. is doing at that point. And a large part of this is because, and it's not just the Clean Air Act and Clinton administration policies, it's also, by and large, the investment of private industry in new technologies that make the use of energy more efficient. Now, I don't have the slide for this. Actually, I do. Let's go to slide four. This is 2005 and 2006, which I didn't put on a chart.
I think three you want, right?
No, four. Okay. 05, we slowed the growth even further. And in 06, the United States of America is the only major industrial country in the world to see an absolute decline in the greenhouse gas emissions. 2006, we're the only country in the world. Since 1990, CO2 emissions have increased an average of about 1.1% annually. That's while our economy has been growing at, over that period of time, a larger rate. 2005, CO2 emissions were 0.06, mm-hmm. 0.6, and we were growing the economy at 3.2%. And then in 06, they decreased 1.6%, and we had economic growth of 3.3. Now, it's not just because of the policies, and it's not just because of the investment. It also has to do with weather patterns. But nonetheless, it does show that there is a reasonable and prudent policy which will allow us, if applied universally, to stabilize and then begin to reduce greenhouse gas emissions without hurting the economy. Now, what we got to do is we laid the predicate for this a couple of years ago with the Asia-Pacific Partnership, where we said, let's get together with Australia, Japan, China, Korea, India, and anybody else in the basin that wants to participate with us, and let's talk about ways that we can attack climate change problems by reducing barriers to the transmission of technology, whether it's the barrier of a tariff or the barrier of a lack of resources or whatever the barrier is to getting these technologies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions into the hands of people who need them in order to use the fuel that they got more efficiently. How can we make this a good business decision for people to begin doing? And we've been working at that in the Asia basin for the last 3 years. The interesting thing about G8 is G8 said, let's restart the Kyoto process. We said, no, why don't we take the model that we have of cooperation and progress in the basin and make it national, international. Let's get everybody, all the major emitters, to use that same process that says we will set a national goal for stabilization and ultimate reduction, and we will examine those policies that keep us from adopting technologies that will allow us to do that.
Why don't we publicize this?
Why don't we publicize that is the question.
I just did.
Yeah,
it is.
Well, besides, why didn't we find some version of a Kyoto-like agreement in which we could have said, we're doing this, so we should...
Well, that's our object. Our object is we have our first meeting this fall. The G8 bought off on this, much to their chagrin. They had to have something, and this was something. But we've got our first meeting this fall with all the major polluters, all the major emitters. They're not called polluters because not everybody agrees that it's a pollutant. They agree that it's an emission. So we got all the major emitters together for the conference this fall. And look, I know how tough the work was in the Asia partnership, but I also know that it has set in motion a whole series of things that are going to be very positive with regard to, I mean, if you get people focused on the question of efficiency, how are we using the energy that we've got efficiently? Suddenly it causes the Chinese to say, you know what, is it worth us to have a giant German diesel sitting behind every production plant because our transmission grid is so bad? Does that make sense? Or does it make sense to put some money into making the transmission grid better? Mm-hmm. And suddenly you go, is it make sense? And some of these decisions take decades. UK is now getting into a place where the UK is stabilizing and may shortly be able to flatline and reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And you know why? Because in the 1970s, Margaret Thatcher broke the back of the coal union and said, I'm putting Britain on a path to nuclear power.
Why aren't we getting on a path to nuclear power?
We are. We have 21 or 22 license applications in process to bring back nuclear power. We've got a major project involved in funding the next generation of nuclear power plants. Good. And we are looking at ways to reduce the amount of stuff that comes out of nuclear power plants by removing the policies adopted under Carter that prevented reprocessing. So what we can do is take the spent nuclear fuel, reprocess it, use it again, take out more of the energy, reprocess it again. It has something to do with that book you wrote, E equals MC squared, and reduce the amount of stuff that we actually at the end we got to store. And look, we're also doing clean coal, and I can't remember all the numbers, but look, we got hundreds of years at coal, and we're And most of our power, 50% of our electric power comes from coal. So the question is, what can we do to make that stuff burn cleaner?
You talk about carbon sequestration.
Carbon sequestration. But we also, look, there are a whole bunch of coal plants today that exist that if retrofitted would put out a lot less gunk. That's where our biggest bang for the buck is. And what we've done is we think the approximate cost of that, and industry agrees, is approximately $10 billion. And under the energy bill we passed several years ago, we got the ability to put out tax credits. We put out last year $1 billion in tax credits. This year we'll put out $650 million more to offset part of the $10 billion that industry is putting in to, again, make their plants more efficient, which thereby has less NOx, SOx, and mercury, and less greenhouse gases, while at the same time they burn their fuel more efficiently. So we're trying to make this a good economic decision. We recognize that tax credits are a distortion of the system, but you know, most of our emissions come from automobiles, but the emissions that we can do something about in a rapid fashion are out of power plants and industrial facilities.
Look, just I'm going to repeat questions if you'll just stand up and ask. Yes, Andrea.
Thanks very much. Hi, Paul. The New York Times reports today that the Pentagon aborted an attempt to go after al-Qaeda in Waziristan, in the tribal areas of Pakistan in the winter of 2005, after there was good intelligence that al-Qaeda leaders were present. Now, there may be a legitimate military defense that the risk was too great, that this apparently would have amounted to an invasion of Pakistan, that Mashar could have been destabilized. But I'm wondering what you say to criticism that the administration has not been aggressive enough against al-Qaeda, has deferred too much to Mashar, especially given administration criticism of the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm. I think you need to examine the record. We're very circumspect in our comments about our predecessor on this issue.
Yeah, but go straight to the question was about the front page story in the New York Times today that Andrea asked about.
This is way outside my lane, so I can't help you on this. I do know there is a sensitivity about the United States taking actions that would destabilize Musharraf. And there's also, the United States has concerns about taking unilateral action in a sovereign nation without their approval. And so this has always been the difficulty we have with unless, of course, they're Saddam Hussein.
Is Musharraf being supportive enough? I'll get it.
Is Musharraf an ally in the war on terror? Yeah. In fact, yesterday they tried to knock him off for whatever it was, the fourth or fifth time. So, yes, he is, and they have been. Now, are there instances where we'd like them to do more? Sure. But we also have to recognize that the tribal region of Pakistan, abutting Afghanistan, has been no man's land, Wild West, for almost since the beginning of the country. And it's difficult for the central government to project its authority there. They're doing a heck of a lot better job today than they were before 2001, steadily, we think, making improvements. Could they do better? I bet. Am I a person who knows what they have done and what they should do? No. Sorry, can't help you on that.
General Powell.
Powell can tell you up through early 05, but I can't.
General Powell.
I was not there at 05. So. I just want to add a comment to the plane issue. Clarification. Carl Redley said that my deputy, Rich Armitage, who spoke to Mr. Novak, it was the tail end of the conversation. And Mr. Novak sort of led with the question, well, what do you know about this? And Armitage said, I think she works for the CIA, and that was about the extent of it, and Bob took it from there. When in October, Mr. Novak wrote another column that suggested who the source might be. At 6:30 that morning, Mr. Armitage called me and said, it's me. So I can be sure. It's me. We spent a couple of hours making sure it was him because of the seriousness of it. I called my legal advisor, and we called the FBI and told the FBI we had information relevant to this investigation that the president is giving. The next morning, on October 2nd and 3rd, the FBI came to the State Department, interviewed Mr. Armitage, interviewed Mr. Me, interviewed my legal counsel, Lee Howard Taft, and they knew everything about Mr. Armitage's involvement. We then called the counsel to the president, Alberto Gonzalez, and said to him, we have contacted the FBI, we're giving them all the information we have. Is there anything else you want to know about it right now? And the answer was no, let the FBI handle it. And so the FBI knew on day one of Mr. Armitage's involvement. Yet, for 2 months after that, the FBI kept investigating. They kept investigating to see who else might have been involved. And when they finished their investigation, they couldn't finish it. And therefore, a special counsel was brought in, Mr. Patterson Fitzgerald. He spent another 2 years. The day he started, he knew what Mr. Armitage's involvement was. And he still went for 2 more years. The reason for that was that there were others involved, and a lot of others, and they couldn't get all of the answers needed to bring this to resolution. And if everybody who had any contact with a reporter during that period had done what Armitage had done, I think this would have ended early on, not dragged out the way it has been.
Let me just add one comment to that. A lot of people visited with the FBI, including me, before October 2nd. So you're right, right from the beginning, people came forward and said, here's the contact we had.
But the implication is, if everybody had come forward right away, said, here's what I did and why I did it, we wouldn't have gone through this.
I'm not certain that's accurate. I think everybody did. And the question was, did the question...
Dick Cheney?
I think the question then became checking everybody's stories against each other. You remember, the underlying offense of Armitage talking to Novak, there was no indictment. There's no violation there. This really became a question of, at the end of the day, comparing everybody's statements to everybody else's statements and saying, are there inconsistencies?
Carl's absolutely right. No crime was committed.
Right. For those applauding, I can tell the word but is about to come.
No crime was committed. My judgment, not a lawyer, but there's somebody watching it. I knew from the first week there would never be a crime established because nobody knew Plain. The word was Wilson at that time. Novak used Plain, but none of us knew at the time, some of us, not me, but Mr. Armitage and others were talking to Novak, that Plain was a covered name. And so if you didn't have knowledge it was a covered name, there was no way for this ever to have been a crime under the existing laws. And Mr. Fitzgerald kept pulling to see whether there was a crime. And he found at the end of the day, there was no crime and nobody was indicted for that. And that was the right answer. Mr. Libby got in trouble for an entirely different set of reasons and circumstances.
Jim, is it? Jim Steyer.
Mr. Rowe, how personally responsible do you feel for the tragedy that's occurred in Iraq over the last 5 or 6 years. And specifically, though, for the packaging and selling of that war, and the way that's impacted the world's view of our country, and even today, your comments about Al-Qaeda being the single biggest factor in Iraq. How do you feel about the consequences today?
Yeah. Look, it is a fact that 85 to 90% of the IEDs going off in Iraq are AQ.
Al-Qaeda.
And look, I make no apologies. It was the right thing to do. The world is better off with him gone. We all thought he had weapons of mass destruction. The whole world did. He didn't. But I'll tell you this. Go back and read the Dulfler and the Kay reports. Both of them say the same thing, which is, that while they found that he did not, they did find that he kept in place the experts and scientists, the knowledge base, if you will, to recreate these weapons. He kept together the dual-use facilities, which could be for biological and chemical weapons, put back into operation relatively quickly. And he kept the desire. He wanted the world to think that he had them. Remember, this guy has his entire country under 16 UN resolutions over the decades of the 90s saying, you need to live up to your commitment made in the aftermath of the Gulf War to disclose and cough all this stuff up. He could have gotten rid of that onerous regime of regulation by the United Nations by simply saying, you know what, I got rid of this stuff, I don't have it anymore, and here's what I did with it. But instead, he wanted the world to think that he had it. Now, the world is better off with him gone. Now, in the aftermath of the withdrawal of the removal of the regime, Al-Qaeda decided to make its stand in Iraq. And we have not to, in my opinion, fight them and win them and beat them there. Otherwise, we're going to face them someplace else. And if we don't fight and beat and win there, They're going to have not Afghanistan with very little in the way of natural resources stuck far out on the periphery of the world from which they struck us on 9/11. They're going to have a country in the heart of the Middle East with the third largest oil reserves in the world. It is, unfortunately, the challenge of our generation to engage in a worldwide struggle against terror. And I think General Abizaid was right. Iraq will either be the beginning of the end of the global war on terror when we win, or it will be the beginning of the war on terror if we lose.
Jane Harmon.
Carl, I want to go back to what Andrea just asked you. The New York Times story today, if true, is enormously disturbing. It is absolutely right. We had a massive intelligence failure. We had many of them. But most people believe that we had Osama bin Laden cornered in Tora Bora in Afghanistan. And because our legal authorities about how to respond were not absolutely organized, he escaped to Waziristan. Most people think he is there now and his top deputies are there now, and that at least symbolically, I think also operationally, it's very important to get them, to capture or kill them. If it is true that the CIA was about to launch an operation to capture or kill Zawahiri, and that may be true, and it was stopped by Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, I think that that not only contravenes our authorities, but I would suggest to you that it was a very unproductive or really disruptive activity. And Rumsfeld is gone now, but the question to you is this administration seriously focused on getting the top al-Qaeda people, or is it not?
Yeah, well, obviously we are. But as you know, and you know better than most, the questions of the quality of the intelligence you're in a better position to know about it, about the quality of the intelligence and the incident involved than I am. But there are subjective judgments about the quality of the intelligence as to whether or not Zawahiri was there or not, what's the quality of it. We also have issues of the assets from the Defense Department. If this was a CIA operation, were they depending on, how did Rumsfeld get involved? Was it involved because he had to provide assets for it, in which case he has a seat at the table to say, is this an operation that I feel confident we have, A, good intelligence that leads us to believe that this is likely to be true, and two, have we taken the steps necessary to get our presumptive ally here involved in this, and three, do I believe that this is appropriate and proper use of the assets? That is to say, do we have a chance to succeed? I wasn't at that table. You weren't at that table. Those are subjective judgments that we need to rely upon the people sitting around that table to make. And I'm not going to jump to depicting a story in the New York Times as being the end-all, be-all on a sophisticated intelligence operation like this may or may not have been.
Ambassador Gildenhorn, I've got a couple of people I've seen over here, too.
First of all,
I'm going to repeat it real quickly because he's such a soft-spoken gentleman. It was about Iran, basically. What do we get about Iran?
Yeah, and sanctions. First of all, I want to thank Joe. Has been leading a very effective. Well, we haven't gotten it done yet, but Joe has been a very passionate advocate. As you know, one of Joe's staff members is one of the five Americans being held by the Iranians under completely bogus charges, and this is a sign of the weakening of the regime that they're doing things like this. Look, this is a country with a fragile economy. They import 40% of their gasoline comes from India. They take the oil, send it to India, refine it into gasoline, and bring it back. They depend for most of their food on imports. They grow very little of their food. Their consumer goods are almost entirely imported. They make very little in the way of their consumer market goods internally. They're a very vulnerable economy. We've been working through our partners, the EU5, Russia, et cetera. Look, we played our sanction card in 1979. There are other sanction, little itsy-bitsy sanction cards that we could conceivably play. Some of them are being played by state legislatures where they're saying that their retirement systems have to divest of any investment in a company that does a certain amount of business in Iran, i.e. a foreign company, can't invest in the French petroleum company, for example. But we played our big card in 1979. Our object now has got to be to get the rest of the world to be serious about playing their cards and convincing them that they have a problem that requires them to join with us in playing the sanction card. And I think we're getting, that process has been long, involved, complicated, but it's been moving along. In fact, I thought it was an interesting, you know, the Russians building the atomic power plants for Iran, and then when they got most of their money and the contract was largely fulfilled, was the point at which they started to say, okay, we're not going to provide you the fuel for the plants until you bring yourself into compliance, and even then we're going to deliver the fuel and take away the fuel. So as time has gone on, and particularly as we've seen changes in Germany and in France, we've got greater hopes that we will be able to bring about a serious international regime that will help force Iran back to the table, suspend their program, and get them back to the table.
I should know this, but were you in Kennebunkport when Putin was there?
I was not.
Do you know what he agreed to that on that Iranian fuel plant?
I ain't saying.
Okay. So you didn't get an agreement? No. Arturo, was it? Will you introduce yourself, too?
Yeah. I'm Atam Tambara from Zimbabwe.
Opposition leader who was jailed after he came here last year in Zimbabwe, and we want to applaud him because he got out of jail.
I put it to you that you can't solve the climate change challenge in America without addressing HIV/AIDS in Africa, without addressing global poverty, without addressing Darfur and Zimbabwe. Are you satisfied that the Bush administration has done enough on Darfur, on HIV/AIDS in Africa, on Zimbabwe, and also on the poverty and travesty of justice in the ghettos of America?
Yeah. Look, the president feels very passionately about what HIV/AIDS and malaria are doing to the continent of Africa. And as a result, we have undertaken an initiative. I want to publicly thank President Clinton for acknowledging our efforts yesterday, because he has been a good partner and has been, you know, this president has been the recipient of a couple of phone calls from him saying, what can I do to help get this through Congress? But our PEPFAR initiative, which is $15 billion in AIDS relief in Africa, is having an amazing and miraculous impact. I think the number, I'm going to be off a bit, there may be an expert here in the audience who knows the numbers better than I, but I think like something like 4 years ago, before the program, there were a grand total of some 40 or 50,000 people in Africa getting antiretroviral drugs, most of them in South Africa. Today there are approaching 1 million. And whole villages have seen the Lazarus effect, where people who literally were dying now are up and around and living lives of value and worth because the United States partnering with willing governments in a program that has standards. We require certain things of the governments in order to participate, and we focus our resources. We're leading the way and working with NGOs that are able to provide the ongoing assistance to make certain that people get the medicine and take the medicine. And, you know, I got to tell you, it was an eye-opening experience, because at the same time that this is going on, there is a global AIDS challenge, and we put the first money into it. And a year later, I think it was Finland was the only other country that had given money. And so that's when the president said, I'm not waiting around for the rest of the world. We're going on our own. And that's when we came forward with PEPFAR. And after that happened, guess what? The Global AIDS Fund filled up, and it's begun now to spend the money, though not at the same rate as our government is, nor do we think as effectively as our government is. We're now beginning a similar initiative on malaria. Because, look, the world is not going to be a stable place if the continent of Africa melts down because of disease and all the instability that that brings into societies. So we're going to have a malaria initiative that is going to be matched with an education initiative primarily aimed at young girls. Because, again, in Africa, you know, the odds of you being HIV or malaria-stricken and uneducated and a woman are very high. And this is something that we as Americans ought to be very proud of, because it is done in the quintessentially American way. We're not waiting for the rest of the world. We're going to go do it. And we're going to have standards. We're going to say we're not going to just throw things at the problem. If you're going to be one of the countries that participates in it, here's how you've got to have skin in the game. And then we say anybody who wants to participate in this, come and do it. If you are an NGO, all you got to prove is that you got a heart, capacity to deliver, and a willingness to be measured. And as a result, some really amazing things are happening in Africa.
And Darfur.
You're going to honor in a couple of weeks a man who did valiant work in helping solve the challenge in the south of the Sudan, Jack Danforth, who, as the president's special envoy on the Sudan, helped bring about an agreement that ended most of the violence in between the north and south. It then moved to the West. And I will tell you this. You go to these international meetings, and the president is passionate about Darfur and passionate about North Korea and passionate about human rights, and the rest of the major players are not that interested in it. But he has made Darfur, and you remember about 6 weeks ago, the president said, I'm unsatisfied with the progress of the United Nations activities and of the world community's efforts, and we're going to step up the sanctions efforts, and we're going to go to the UN and seek a resolution. Ban Ki-moon asked us to hold off doing that immediately, so we announced that we would take those steps. We gave him a reasonable period of time to affect change. Nothing happened, and so we're moving forward on that. This is genocide, pure and simple, the destruction of a people on pure hatred, and it is sanctioned by Khartoum. It is a deliberate policy of Khartoum. The world has turned a blind eye to it, and the African Union has been willing to put troops in. They need authority to do so and the support of the world community and assets in order to move them in, and the United States is taking the lead and saying enough is enough. The world community must act. And this fall,
so we will use military assets to help the OAU move in.
Well, I'm not certain that at the end the United States may do that, or the United States may work with partners so the partners do that. Okay. We're not the only people in the world that have C-130s. We make them for a lot of people around the world. But the AU peacekeeping force needs some logistical assistance in particular to be able to move in and out of the country.
And I think the last part of the question was inner city poverty in America, the intractability and the, I guess, growing inequality.
Yeah, look, and again, I know you've talked with Margaret Spellings about this. You know, the president feels passionately about what he calls the soft bigotry of low expectations. He believes that a lot of the pathologies of America's inner cities and a lot of the disparity between affluence that we have, and we do have affluence. I mean, even, you know, a lot of people around the world would go to what is a poor house in America and be amazed at what we consider to be, you know, sort of impoverished. But nonetheless, there is a gap, and the gap is going to grow wider on the basis of education if we don't do something about it. We were in Harlem with Charlie Rangel recently, and Rangel said less than 40% of the students in his high schools in his district in Harlem graduate from high school.
Less than 40%.
And, I mean, how can we as a country in which we're increasingly a knowledge-based society hope to have everybody moving ahead if we aren't able to graduate black, brown, poor kids from high school and give them a chance to go on to college? Now, there's a lot going on in America that's very positive. More people are going to college today in history as a percentage of the kids graduating from high school and as a percentage of all young people. We're at record numbers, and they're getting a quality education. May not be at, you know, UCLA, but it's at their community college, and maybe they go on to the four-year institute, state institution, but they're getting a quality higher education. Our problem is K-1 through 12, where there are gross disparities across this country, and it is on the basis of a system that does not function. I'll tell you, I was in New York City on that same visit, and I was with Joe Klein, who's doing an incredible job. I mean, the guy has a heart as big as the city that he represents. I mean, it's really remarkable what he's doing. And we went to a school in Harlem in which the number of students was enough that they only needed three floors of the school. So they gave the fourth floor of the school over to a charter school. And I got to tell you, it was inspiring. There was this, I sat in this classroom. It was a math class for fifth and sixth graders. And I think they were researchers on Walter's book. Seriously. I mean, these kids were doing math I couldn't comprehend. What is the Schwarzschild radius, incidentally? I'm struggling with that.
That makes a black hole.
Yeah, okay, good. Thank you. Just checking. He understood his own book. It's really remarkable. But anyway, we're sitting in this classroom, and there is the guy who is a janitor. He's a janitor in an office building in Manhattan. And he's there with his daughter. And the guy is painfully, awkwardly dressed. And I got to talking to him, and he talked about the sacrifices to get his daughter to this charter school. He brings her to the charter school. He comes across, he lives on the west side. He brings her over, packs her lunch. I think he's a single dad, from what I could piece together. He brings her there. He arranges to pick her up, takes her to work with him after school. She waits there for him. Then they go home together. And he said, I said, why, you know, and he talked about the sacrifices he had to make. And he said, I want her to have a chance to go to college. And I said to her, have you been thinking about college? She says, yeah, I'm going to Harvard. And after talking to her, she's going to be at Harvard. One way or another, she's going to be at Harvard. I talked to their teacher. The kid went to Harvard. After he got out of school, he said, I'm going to go work in the public school system as a teacher, science teacher. And he worked in the public school system, and he said, I hated it. So he joined, I think it's Teach for America, and is teaching in a school. And I said, well, what do you hate about public education? He said, I hate the unions. He said, they make it impossible for good teachers to succeed. They breed mediocrity. They took good teachers and dragged them down. The system has got to be blown up, and the only way to blow it up is through charters and choice, and that's why I'm here. Now, I got to thinking about this incredibly bright, articulate math major from Harvard and what this kid could be making in our marketplace as a, you know, I mean, God, what kind of future has that guy got? And that guy is devoted to teaching on the fourth floor with no elevator of a school in Harlem. Now, it says something about people's willingness to tackle this problem. It says something about the challenge that we face, because it's not just Harlem. It is Dallas. It's New Orleans. It's, you know, it's rural Colorado. We have a system that is not based upon measuring every child, identifying whether, having high standards, measuring children against those standards, asking whether or not the system is getting them taught what they need, providing extra help to get them up to speed. That's what No Child Left Behind aims to do. And it's starting to have an impact. And Margaret may have talked about this when she's here. It blows me away that even as we start to put this into place, and we got a lot of things that we got to work out, kinks to work out in it, and we rely upon the state setting the standards. So we got states that say, oh yeah, our standard is see Jane run. And others say it is what it ought to be. But even though it's imperfect, we have seen more improvement in reading math scores in the last 5 years since it was adopted, K-1 through 12, than in the previous 28 years combined. I mentioned earlier on immigration, if you can't measure it, it doesn't get done. Well, if you can't measure your progress in teaching every single child, you're not going to make certain that you teach every single child. And the only way we're going to be able to get that is to put an accountability system on our public schools and inject enough choice and enough competition, whether it's public school charters or it's vouchers or whatever it is at the local level, to give just enough oomph, just enough competition, so the public school oligarchy says we better get our act together or there's going to be somebody else who's going to take our job.
Just a small tout for the Aspen Institute, which is when the No Child Left Behind reauthorization became controversial, both Congress, Secretary Spellings, yeah, and the Ford Foundation came to us to say, yeah, do a commission, and it was Roy Barnes of Georgia and Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, yeah, that we asked to lead it, and we did come up with what I think is a new, yeah, reauthorization.
This is going to be one of these really weird laws that as we fight for, first of all, here's the dirty secret, we don't need to reauthorize it. If it gets reauthorized with improvements, great, but if it doesn't get reauthorized, the law stays on the books. So our object is to improve it, and if they won't approve it, then we're not going to let them water it down. But this is a bill that's going to be hit with an odd conglomeration of people on the right and people on the left, all doing the bidding of the teacher unions who do not want assessment. And you cannot tell whether or not a child is learning unless you are testing to see, are they learning?
Right here, one question, quick. Yeah, Guantanamo. I should have asked you that. Yeah.
And it raises the question, this is after they had decided not to hear it, and the speculation is that Justice Kennedy came on board because of this report that they're basically a sham. And this is just the latest in a spate of rebukes that the administration has received.
This is a question on Guantanamo. I'm sorry, we're going to really have to wrap it up, so let me let him get to it. And, of course, the president a year ago said, let's close down Guantanamo. Yeah. Isn't he the president? Yeah. Why don't we close down Guantanamo?
Well, we're talking with Congress about what comes after Gitmo because, you know, I'm sure the Pitkin County Jail would love to have these people arrive here. But
it can't take that long to figure out how to get these people out of
Guantanamo. Not with this Congress. Look, we didn't consider a rebuke. We welcomed it. We think that it's important for the Supreme Court to be held, to be heard from on the question of what do you do with enemy, you know, with enemy unlawful combatants. No. Look. I mean, we were told that U.S. citizen had a certain, if you were a U.S. citizen being held down there, you had a certain rights. If you were held on U.S. soil, you had certain rights, even if you were an alien. not a U.S. citizen. So we're happy to have this clarified, because we're, look, what other war have we faced an enemy that has not signed the Geneva Accord since the Geneva Accords have been around? What war have we engaged in when we have people who don't wear a uniform, don't recognize a government, and don't abide by whatever the commonly established rules of law of war are at that point? This is it. So we welcome the Supreme Court helping clarify this situation. We would like to, the President would like to close Gitmo, but we need to close Gitmo by doing two or three things. One is by getting countries to accept back their nationals so that they can make a decision about what to do with them. Second, by making decisions about each one of those individuals as to whether or not they represent a continuing threat. And thirdly, having a process in place, the military commissions and whatever else there is after that, that allows us to try these people and hold them. Now, remember, this is sort of unusual. I don't remember this kind of hubbub in World War II when we had Arizona and New Mexico filled with camps full of Nazis.
But well, we feel bad about the internment camps of the Japanese in World War II.
Yeah, but anybody who suggests that the Japanese internment camps in which U.S. Military personnel were killed, starved, and tortured compared to Gitmo, which is overseen by regular visits of the International Red Cross, in which our principal health problem down there is gain of weight. Yeah. We feed them so well. So
look, we go to extraordinary,
I think Gitmo is a necessary component of the war on terror. Let's find something else, but let's have an agreement on what that is. Because look, it may not be Gitmo, but it's going to be the brig in Charleston, South Carolina, or it's going to be the Pitkin County Jail. It's going to be the Florence, Colorado Federal Maximum Security Facility. We got to hold them someplace. These are bad people.
Right.
These are people who threaten the United States of America.
We have a constitution and habeas corpus. We can hold bad people.
We have a constitution. That applies to U.S. citizens.
Okay.
We have habeas corpus rights that apply to U.S. citizens. We have an international code that applies to all the signatories of that code with regard to how you treat military prisoners prisoners of war. And guess what? I don't see Mr. Zawahiri or Osama bin Laden's signature on that document, nor have the way that they handle people like Daniel Pearl been in keeping with the international code of war.
Let me wrap this up by asking you, as we look forward to the next election, there are five or six major issues: Iraq, terrorism, education, global warming or environment, energy policy. Do you think Iraq will be the major issue? And as you do that, could you give us a sense of where you see the four or five Republican candidates standing and the three or four Democrats?
I'm going to disappoint you mightily. I'm not going to comment on individual candidates next year. I think Iraq may or may not be the big issue. It depends on where Iraq is by March or April or May of next year. I think it's likely not to be the dominant issue because I think because of my assumptions about where it is, where I think it's likely to be. I think it may also be less of an issue because if you're a Democrat, you do not want to be in a place where on January 21st, 2009, if a Democrat gets elected president, the Democrat president faces the likelihood there'll be U.S. troops in Iraq. And so if you want the issue to be toned down, because you don't want to be in a place where on January 21, if you're a Democrat and you get elected, you face one of two options. You bring them home precipitously, and virtually everybody agrees the country descends into chaos, and that's on your watch, or that you keep them there in a reasonable configuration, redeployed, and in which case a large part of your party is angry with you. So I think this is sort of like Korea in 1952 and 53, where Eisenhower made a comment which led people to believe that he was for change, I'll go to Korea, but in essence kept in place the policies of Truman after the election. And for Republicans, I think again, they similarly like to be able to talk about taxes, spending, values, national security, but in a broader context, national security in a broader context than just Iraq. But I'll tell you this, it is going to be a barn burner of a race. It's going to be a barn burner of a race because the process is so jammed together that the country, I think, is going to ill serve the candidates and ill serve the country. But, you have within the space of less than 2 weeks, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida. Now, we had Iowa, which we won, and 8 days later, New Hampshire, which we lost, and 19 days later, South Carolina, where we were able to climb back and win. What happens when you compress four major primaries into essentially 10, what is it? It's going to be 12 days.
Wow.
And as a result, what's going to happen is we're going into uncharted territory as to how is the early winter in Iowa going to affect New Hampshire? Is the winter in New Hampshire going to affect South Carolina? It did last time. Iowa didn't affect New Hampshire, but New Hampshire affected South Carolina. We went from being 16 up in South Carolina the day before the New Hampshire primary to 6 down 24 hours later. And is that going to, you know, is somebody going to win someplace in a way that grabs the national imagination? We also are going to have a contest. Think about this. We're on now the 8th of July. In 1999, George W. Bush had made his first campaign appearance on June 16th, 22 days ago. He'd had his first campaign fundraiser on the 19th of June. On the 30th of June, at $1,000 a clip, he reported a grand total of $37 million. We've now got candidates who began running at about 100. You know, John McCain, I saw this week, had 150 staff members. We had in the 99-2000 campaign, we had 150 campaign staffers, I think, on or about September of 2000, over a year from now. So these guys have all been running. I mean, we've already had how many debates? I mean, too many. More than three. We've got three on the Democrat side alone. I mean, six, eight, something like that. I mean,
1.3 million, I think, was the answer, right?
Yeah, 1.5. 1.5. I mean, these people have been running flat out since last November. They have a campaign, you know, they were appearing last November and December at a pace that was equivalent to what we were appearing at in November and December of 99 and January of 2000. Now, is that healthy? No. Because, first of all, they're going to be exhausted by the time they get chosen. And then they're going to go into a bone-charring general election, and that's going to take more out of them. So they're going to somebody's going to get elected president and be completely exhausted. And they will not have had time to think for 2 years. I mean, part of what they're doing, you know, when Obama goes to the debate on health care in Nevada in February and stands up and says, I don't have a health care plan, but I'll have one by next January, it shows that the pace of this thing is outrunning the substantive process. People are not having time to sit down and think and walk these things through and put the numbers together and listen to interesting minds and be challenged and develop what it is that they want to say that is something beyond the press guy coming in saying, here's your soundbite for this afternoon. And that is really problematic and not helpful for the country.
Carl, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Really cool.
Walter, can I just, everyone? Can I get your attention just for a second? Okay, we are a few minutes behind schedule, so if we can all synchronize our watches. It is 10:15.